Wheat, of course. For years, this simple fact eluded nutrition scientists. After all, dietary fats, maligned and feared, are composed of triglycerides. Logically, increased intake of fatty foods, such as greasy meats and butter, should increase blood levels of triglycerides. This proved true, but only transiently and to a small degree. More recently, it has become clear that, while increased intake of fats does indeed deliver greater quantities of triglycerides into the liver and bloodstream, it also shuts down the body's own production of triglycerides. Because the body is able to produce large quantities of triglycerides that handily overwhelm the modest amount taken in during a meal, the net effect of high fat intake is little or no change in triglyceride levels. Carbohydrates, on the other hand, contain virtually no triglycerides. Two slices of whole grain bread, an onion bagel, or sourdough pretzel contain negligible triglycerides. But carbohydrates possess the unique capacity to stimulate insulin, which in turn triggers fatty acid synthesis in the liver, a process that floods the bloodstream with triglycerides. Depending on genetic susceptibility to the effect, carbohydrates can send triglycerides into the hundreds or even thousands of milligrams per deciliter range. The body is so efficient at producing triglycerides that high levels, e.g. 300 milligrams per deciliter, 500 milligrams per deciliter, even 1,000 milligrams per deciliter or more, can be sustained 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for years, provided the flow of carbohydrates continues. In fact, the recent discovery of the process of de novo lipogenesis, the liver alchemy that converts sugars into triglycerides, has revolutionized the way nutritionists view food and its effects on lipoproteins and metabolism. One of the crucial phenomena required to begin this metabolic cascade is high levels of insulin in the bloodstream. High insulin levels stimulate the machinery for de novo lipogenesis in the liver, efficiently transforming carbohydrates into triglycerides, which are then packaged into VLDL particles. Today, approximately half of all calories consumed by most Americans come from carbohydrates. The early 21st century will go down in history as the age of carbohydrate consumption. Such a dietary pattern means that de novo lipogenesis can proceed to such extreme degrees that the excess fat created infiltrates the liver. That's why so-called non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, NAFLD, and non-alcoholic steatosis, NAS, have reached such epidemic proportions that gastroenterologists have their own convenient abbreviations for them. NAFLD and NAS lead to liver cirrhosis, an irreversible disease similar to that experienced by alcoholics, thus the non-alcoholic disclaimer. Ducks and geese are also capable of packing their livers full of fat, an adaptation that allows them to fly long distances without sustenance, drawing on stored liver fat for energy during annual migration. For fowl, it's part of an evolutionary adaptation. Farmers take advantage of this fact when they produce geese and duck livers full of fat, feed the birds carbohydrates from grains, yielding foie gras and the fatty pâté you spread on whole wheat crackers. But for humans, fatty liver is a perverse, unphysiologic consequence of being told to consume more carbohydrates. Unless you're dining with Hannibal Lecter, you don't want a foie gras-like liver in your abdomen. This makes sense. Carbohydrates are the foods that encourage fat storage, a means of preserving the bounty from times of plenty. If you were a primitive human, satiated from your meal of freshly killed boar, topped off with some wild berries and fruit, you would store the excess calories in case you failed to catch another boar or other prey in the coming days or even weeks. Insulin helps store the excess energy as fat, transforming it into triglycerides that pack the liver and spill over into the bloodstream, energy stores to be drawn from when the hunt fails. But in our bountiful modern times, the flow of calories, especially those from carbohydrates, such as grains, never stops, but flows endlessly. Today, every day is a day of plenty. The situation is worsened when excess visceral fat accumulates. Visceral fat acts as a triglyceride repository, but one that causes a constant flow of triglycerides into and out of fat cells, triglycerides that enter the bloodstream. This results in liver exposure to higher blood levels of triglycerides, which further drives VLDL production. Diabetes provides a convenient testing ground for the effects of high carbohydrate eating, such as a diet rich in healthy whole grains. The majority of adult type 2 diabetes is brought on by excessive carbohydrate consumption, High blood sugars and diabetes itself are reversed in many, if not most, cases by reduction of carbohydrates. Diabetes is associated with a characteristic lipid triad of low HDL, high triglycerides, and small LDL, the very same pattern created by excessive carbohydrate consumption. Dietary fats, therefore, make only a modest contribution to VLDL production, while carbohydrates make a much larger contribution. This is why low-fat diets, rich in, quote, healthy whole grains, unquote, have become notorious for increasing triglyceride levels, a fact often glossed over as harmless by advocates of such diets. My personal low-fat adventure many years ago, in which I restricted intake of all fats, animal and otherwise, to less than 10% of calories, a very strict diet, a la Ornish and others, gave me a triglyceride level of 350 milligrams per deciliter due to the plentiful, healthy whole grains I substituted for the reduced fats and meats. Low-fat diets typically sent triglycerides up to the 150, 200, or 300 milligram per deciliter range. In genetically susceptible people who struggle with triglyceride metabolism, low-fat diets can cause triglycerides to skyrocket to the thousands of milligrams per deciliter range, sufficient to cause fatty liver NAFLD and NAS, as well as damage to the pancreas. Low-fat diets are not benign. The high-carbohydrate, plentiful whole grain intake that unavoidably results when fat calories are reduced triggers higher blood glucose, higher insulin, greater deposition of visceral fat, and more VLDL and triglycerides, all of which cascades into greater proportions of small LDL particles. If carbohydrates such as wheat trigger the entire domino effect of VLDL, triglycerides, small LDL particles, then reducing carbohydrates should do the opposite, particularly reducing the dominant dietary carbohydrate, wheat. To Lipitor or not, the role of wheat. As noted earlier, wheat consumption increases LDL cholesterol. Eliminating wheat reduces LDL cholesterol, all by way of small LDL particles. But it may not look that way at first. Here's where it gets kind of confusing. The standard lipid panel that your doctor relies on to crudely gauge risk for heart disease uses a calculated LDL cholesterol value, not a measured value. All you need is a calculator to sum up LDL cholesterol from the following equation, called the Friedwald calculation. LDL cholesterol equals total cholesterol minus HDL cholesterol, triglycerides divided by 5. The three values on the right side of the equation, total cholesterol, HDL cholesterol, and triglycerides, are indeed measured. Only LDL cholesterol is calculated. The problem is that this equation was developed by making several assumptions. For this equation to work and yield reliable LDL cholesterol values, for instance, HDL must be 40 milligrams per deciliter or greater, triglycerides 100 milligrams per deciliter or less. Any deviation from these values and the calculated LDL value will be thrown off. Diabetes, in particular, throws off the accuracy of the calculation, often to an extreme degree. 50% inaccuracy is not uncommon. Genetic variants can also throw the calculation off. For instance, ApoE variants. Another problem, if LDL particles are small, calculated LDL will underestimate real LDL. Conversely, if LDL particles are large, calculated LDL will overestimate real LDL. To make the situation even more confusing, if you shift LDL particles from undesirably small to healthy or large by some change in diet, a good thing, the calculated LDL value will often appear to go up, while the real value is actually going down. While you achieved a genuinely beneficial change by reducing small LDL, your doctor tries to persuade you to take a statin drug for the appearance of high LDL cholesterol. That's why I call LDL cholesterol fictitious LDL, a criticism that has not stopped the ever-enterprising pharmaceutical industry from deriving $27 billion in annual revenues from sales of statin drugs. Maybe you benefit, maybe you don't. Calculated LDL cholesterol might not tell you, even though that is the FDA-approved indication. High calculated LDL cholesterol. The only way for you and your doctor to truly know where you stand is to actually measure LDL particles in some way, such as LDL particle number, by a laboratory method called nuclear magnetic resonance, or NMR, lipoprotein analysis, or apoprotein B. Because there is one apoprotein B molecule per one LDL particle, apoprotein B provides a virtual LDL particle count. It's not that tough, but it requires a health practitioner willing to invest the extra bit of education to understand these issues. If thy right eye offend thee, and if thy right eye offend thee, pluck it out, and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell. Matthew, chapter 5, verse 29. Dr. Ronald Krauss and his colleagues at the University of California, Berkeley, were pioneers in drawing the connection between carbohydrate intake and small LDL particles. In a series of studies, they demonstrated that as carbohydrates, as a percentage of diet, increased from 20 to 65% and fat content decreased, there was an explosion of small LDL particles. Even people who start with zero small LDL particles can be forced to develop them by increasing the carbohydrate content of their diet. Conversely, people with plenty of small LDL particles will show marked reductions, approximately 25%, with reduction in carbohydrates and an increase in fat intake over just several weeks. Dr. Jeff Volek and his colleagues at the University of Connecticut have also published a number of studies demonstrating the lipoprotein effects of reduced carbohydrates. In one such study, carbohydrates, including wheat flour products, sugared soft drinks, foods made of cornstarch or cornmeal, potatoes, and rice were eliminated, reducing carbohydrates to 10% of total calories. Subjects were instructed to consume unlimited beef, poultry, fish, eggs, cheese, nuts and seeds, and low-carbohydrate vegetables and salad dressings. Over 12 weeks, small LDL particles were reduced by 26%. From the standpoint of small LDL particles, it is nearly impossible to tease out the effects of wheat versus other carbohydrates, such as candy, soft drinks, and chips, since all of these foods trigger small LDL formation to varying degrees. We can safely predict, however, that foods that increase blood sugar the most also trigger insulin the most, followed by the most vigorous stimulation of de novo lipogenesis in the liver and greater visceral fat deposition, followed by increased VLDL triglycerides and small LDL. Wheat, of course, fits that description perfectly, triggering greater spikes in blood sugar than nearly all other foods. Accordingly, reduction or elimination of wheat yields unexpectedly vigorous reductions in small LDL, provided the lost calories are replaced with those from vegetables, proteins, and fats. Did you say statin drug? Chuck came to me because he had heard that it was possible to reduce cholesterol without drugs. Although it had been labeled high cholesterol, what Chuck really had, as uncovered by lipoprotein testing, was a great excess of small LDL particles. Measured by one technique, NMR, he showed 2,440 nanomoles per liter small LDL particles. Little to none is desirable. This gave Chuck the appearance of high LDL cholesterol of 190 milligrams per deciliter, along with low HDL cholesterol of 39 milligrams per deciliter and high triglycerides of 173 milligrams per deciliter. 3 months into his wheat-free experience, he replaced lost wheat calories with real foods such as raw nuts, eggs, cheese, vegetables, meats, avocados, and olive oil. Chuck's small LDL was reduced to 320 nanomoles per liter. This was reflected on the surface by an LDL cholesterol of 123 milligrams per deciliter, an increase in HDL to 45 milligrams per deciliter, a drop in triglycerides to 45 milligrams per deciliter, and 14 pounds of weight lost from his belly. Yes, indeed. Marked and rapid reduction of cholesterol. No statin drug in sight. Can heart healthy cause heart disease? Who doesn't love a Mission Impossible double agent story, where the trusted companion or lover suddenly double-crosses the secret agent, having worked for the enemy all along? How about the nefarious side of wheat? It's a food that has been painted as your savior in the battle against heart disease, yet the most current research shows it is anything but. Angelina Jolie made a movie about multiple layers of espionage and betrayal called Salt. How about a similar movie starring Russell Crowe called Wheat, about a middle-aged businessman who thinks he's eating healthy foods, only to find out? Okay, maybe not. While Wonder Bread claims to build strong bodies 12 ways, the many heart-healthy varieties of bread and other wheat products come in a range of disguises. But whether stone ground, sprouted grain, or sourdough, organic, fair trade, handcrafted, or home-baked, it's still wheat. It is still a combination of gluten proteins, glutenins, and amylopectin, triggering wheat's unique panel of inflammatory effects, neurologically active exorphins, and excessive glucose levels. Don't be misled by other health claims attached to a wheat product. It may be vitamin-enriched with synthetic B vitamins, but it's still wheat. It could be organic stone-ground whole-grain bread with added omega-3 from flax oil, but it's still wheat. It could help you have regular bowel movements and emerge from the ladies' room with a satisfied smile, but it's still wheat. It could be taken as the sacrament and blessed by the Pope, but, holy or not, it's still wheat. I think you're probably getting the idea. I hammer this point home because it exposes a common ploy used by the food industry. Add heart-healthy ingredients to a food and call it a heart-healthy muffin, cracker, or bread. Fiber, for instance, does indeed have modest health benefits. So does the linolenic acid of flaxseed and flaxseed oil. But no heart-healthy ingredient will erase the adverse health effects of the wheat. Heart-healthy bread, packed with fiber and omega-3 fats, will still trigger high blood sugar, glycation, visceral fat deposition, small LDL particles, exorphin release, and inflammatory responses. If you can't stand the wheat, get out of the kitchen. Foods that increase blood glucose to a greater degree therefore trigger VLDL production by the liver. Greater VLDL availability through interaction with LDL particles favors formation of small LDL particles that linger for longer periods of time in the bloodstream. High blood glucose encourages glycation of LDL particles, particularly those that are already oxidized. LDL particle longevity, oxidation, glycation, it all adds up to heightened potential to trigger the formation and growth of atherosclerotic plaque in arteries. Who's the head honcho, the top dog, the master at creating VLDL, small LDL, and glycation? Wheat, of course. There's a silver lining to this dark wheat cloud. If wheat consumption causes marked increase in small LDL and all its associated phenomena, then elimination of wheat should reverse it. Indeed, that is what happens. Dramatic reductions in small LDL particles can be accomplished by eliminating wheat products, provided your diet is otherwise healthy and you don't replace lost wheat calories with other foods that contain sugar or readily convert to sugar on consumption. Think of it this way. Anything that provokes an increase in blood sugar will also, in parallel, provoke small LDL particles. Anything that keeps blood sugar from increasing, such as proteins, fats, and reduction in carbohydrates, such as wheat, reduces small LDL particles. Note that the insight gained by looking at LDL particles rather than LDL cholesterol leads us to conclusions about diet that are in stark contrast to the conventional advice for heart health. In effect, the popular fiction of calculated LDL cholesterol has perpetuated another fiction, that of the health benefits of reducing fat and increasing consumption of healthy whole grains. All the while, when viewed from the deeper insights gained from techniques such as lipoprotein analysis, we see that this advice achieved the opposite of what it intended. The China Study, a love story. The China Study is a 20-year effort conducted by Cornell University's Dr. Colin Campbell to study the eating habits and health of the Chinese people. Dr. Campbell argues that the data show that people who ate the most animal-based foods got the most chronic disease. People who ate the most plant-based foods were the healthiest and tended to avoid chronic disease. The China Study findings have been held up as evidence that all animal products exert adverse health effects and that the human diet should be plant-based. To Dr. Campbell's credit, the data were made available to anyone interested in reviewing them in his 894-page book, Diet, Lifestyle, and Mortality in China, 1990. One person with a deep fascination with health and numbers took him up on his offer, and over months of data crunching, performed an extensive reanalysis. Denise Minger, a 23-year-old raw food advocate and former vegan, dove into Campbell's data, hoping to understand the raw findings, and made her analyses public in a blog she started in January 2010. Then the fireworks began. After months of reanalysis, Minger came to believe that Campbell's original conclusions were flawed, and that many of the purported findings were due to selective interpretation of the data. But what was most astounding was what she uncovered about wheat. Let Ms. Minger tell the story in her own, quite capable words. When I first started analyzing the original China study data, I had no intention of writing up an actual critique of Campbell's much-lauded book. I'm a data junkie. I mainly wanted to see for myself how closely Campbell's claims aligned with the data he drew from, if only to satisfy my own curiosity. I was a vegetarian vegan for over a decade, and have nothing but respect for those who choose a plant-based diet, even though I am no longer vegan. My goal, with the China study analysis and elsewhere, is to figure out the truth about nutrition and health without the interference of biases and dogma. I have no agenda to promote. I propose that Campbell's hypothesis is not altogether wrong, but more accurately, incomplete. While he has skillfully identified the importance of whole, unprocessed foods in achieving and maintaining health, his focus on wedding animal products with disease has come at the expense of exploring, or even acknowledging, the presence of other diet disease patterns that may be stronger, more relevant, and ultimately more imperative for public health and nutritional research. Sins of omission. Perhaps more troubling than the distorted facts in the China study are the details Campbell leaves out. Why does Campbell indict animal foods in cardiovascular disease, correlation of 0.01 for animal protein, and minus 0.11 for fish protein, yet failed to mention that wheat flour has a correlation of 0.67 with heart attacks and coronary heart disease, and plant proteins correlates at 0.25 with these conditions? Why doesn't Campbell also note the astronomical correlations wheat flour has with various diseases, 0.46 with cervical cancer, 0.54 with hypertensive heart disease, 0.47 with stroke, 0.41 with diseases of the blood and blood-forming organs, and the aforementioned 0.67 with myocardial infarction and coronary heart disease? Could the Grand Prix of epidemiology have accidentally uncovered a link between the Western world's leading cause of death and its favorite glutinous grain? Is the staff of life really the staff of death? When we pluck out the wheat variable from the 1989 China Study 2 questionnaire, which has more recorded data, and consider potential non-linearity, the outcome is even creepier. Wheat is the strongest positive predictor of body weight out of any diet variable. And it's not just because wheat eaters are taller, either, because wheat consumption also strongly correlates with body mass index. What's the only thing heart disease-prone regions have in common with westernized nations? That's right, consumption of high amounts of wheat flour. The full impressive text of Ms. Minger's ongoing ideas can be found in her blog, Raw Food SOS, at http://rawfoodsos.com. Chapter 11. It's All in Your Head. Wheat and the Brain. Okay, so wheat messes with your bowels, amps up your appetite, and makes you the brunt of beer belly jokes. But is it really that bad? Wheat's effects reach the brain in the form of opiate-like peptides. But the polypeptide exorphins responsible for these effects come and go, dissipating over time. Exorphins cause your brain to instruct you to eat more food, increase calorie consumption, and desperately scratch at the stale crackers at the bottom of the box when there's nothing else left. But all these effects are reversible. Stop eating wheat, the effect goes away. The brain recovers, and you're again ready to help your teenager tackle quadratic equations. But wheat's effects on the brain don't end there. Among the most disturbing of wheat's effects are those exerted on brain tissue itself. Not just on thoughts and behavior, but on the cerebrum, cerebellum, and other nervous system structures, with consequences ranging from incoordination to incontinence, from seizures to dementia. And unlike addictive phenomena, these are not entirely reversible. Watch where you step. Wheat and cerebellar health. Imagine I was to blindfold you and set you loose in an unfamiliar room, full of odd angles, nooks and crannies, and randomly placed objects to stumble over. Within a few steps, you're likely to find yourself face first in the shoe rack. Such are the struggles of someone with a condition known as cerebellar ataxia. But these people struggle with eyes wide open. These are the people you often see using canes and walkers, or stumbling over a crack in the sidewalk that results in a fractured leg or hip. Something has impaired their ability to navigate the world, causing them to lose control over balance and coordination, functions centered in a region of the brain called the cerebellum. The majority of people with cerebellar ataxia consult with a neurologist, often to have their condition deemed idiopathic, without known cause. No treatment is prescribed, nor has a treatment been developed. The neurologist simply suggests a walker, advises removing potential stumbling hazards in the home, and discusses adult diapers for the urinary incontinence that will eventually develop. Cerebellar ataxia is progressive, getting worse with each passing year, until the sufferer is unable to comb his hair, brush his teeth, or go to the bathroom alone. Even the most basic self-care activities will eventually need to be performed by someone else. At this point, the end is near, as such extreme debilitation hastens complications such as pneumonia and infected bed sores. Between 10 and 22.5% of people with celiac disease have nervous system involvement. Of all forms of ataxia that are diagnosed, 20% have abnormal blood markers for gluten. Of people with unexplained ataxia, that is, no other cause can be identified, abnormal blood markers for gluten are measured in 50% of the afflicted. Problem. The majority of people with ataxia triggered by wheat gluten have no signs or symptoms of intestinal disease, no celiac-like warnings to send the signal that gluten sensitivity is at work. The destructive immune response responsible for the diarrhea and abdominal cramps of celiac disease can also be directed against brain tissue, while the gluten-brain connection underlying neurological impairment was suspected as long ago as 1966, it was thought to be due to the nutritional deficiencies accompanying celiac disease. More recently, it has become clear that brain and nervous system involvement results from a direct immune attack on nerve cells. The anti-gliadin antibodies triggered by gluten can bind to Purkinje cells of the brain, cells unique to the cerebellum. Brain tissue such as Purkinje cells do not have the capacity to regenerate. Once damaged, cerebellar Purkinje cells are gone, forever. In addition to loss of balance and coordination, wheat-induced cerebellar ataxia can show such odd phenomena as, in the arcane language of neurology, nystagmus, lateral involuntary twitching of the eyeballs, myoclonus, involuntary muscle twitching, and chorea, chaotic involuntary jerking motions of the limbs. One study of 104 people with cerebellar ataxia also revealed impaired memory and verbal abilities, suggesting that wheat-induced destruction may involve cerebral tissue, the seat of higher thought and memory. The typical age of onset of symptoms of wheat-induced cerebellar ataxia is 48 to 53. On MRI of the brain, 60% show atrophy of the cerebellum, reflecting the irreversible destruction of Purkinje cells. Only limited recovery of neurological function occurs with wheat gluten elimination due to the poor capacity of brain tissue to regenerate. Most people simply stop getting worse once the flow of gluten stops. The first hurdle in diagnosing ataxia that develops from wheat exposure is to have a physician who even considers the diagnosis in the first place. This can be the toughest hurdle of all, since much of the medical community continues to embrace the notion that wheat is good for you. Once considered, however, the diagnosis is a bit trickier than just diagnosing intestinal celiac disease, especially since some antibodies, the IgA form specifically, are not involved in wheat-induced brain disease. Add to this the little problem that a brain biopsy is objectionable to most people, and it takes a well-informed neurologist to make the diagnosis. The diagnosis may rest on a combination of suspicion and positive HLA-DQ markers, along with observation of improvement or stabilization with wheat and gluten elimination. The painful reality of cerebellar ataxia is that, in the great majority of cases, you won't know you have it until you start tripping over your own feet, drifting into walls, or wetting your pants. Once it shows itself, your cerebellum likely is already shrunken and damaged. Halting all wheat and gluten ingestion at this point is only likely to keep you out of the assisted living facility. All of this due to the muffins and bagels you so crave. From your head down to your toes, wheat and peripheral neuropathy. While cerebellar ataxia is due to wheat-triggered immune reactions on the brain, a parallel condition occurs in the nerves of the legs, pelvis, and other organs. It is called peripheral neuropathy. A common cause of peripheral neuropathy is diabetes. High blood sugars occurring repeatedly over several years damage the nerves in the legs, causing reduced sensation, thus allowing a diabetic to step on a thumbtack without knowing it, diminished control over blood pressure and heart rate, and sluggish emptying of the stomach, diabetic gastroparesis, among other manifestations of a nervous system gone haywire. A similar degree of nervous system chaos occurs with wheat exposure. The average age of onset of gluten-induced peripheral neuropathy is 55. As with cerebellar ataxia, the majority of sufferers do not have intestinal symptoms that suggest celiac disease. Unlike cerebellar Purkinje cells' inability to regenerate, peripheral nerves have limited capacity to undergo repair once the offending wheat and gluten are removed, with the majority of people experiencing at least partial reversal of their neuropathy. In one study of 35 gluten-sensitive patients with peripheral neuropathy who were positive for the anti-gliadin antibody, the 25 participants on a wheat and gluten-free diet improved over 1 year, while the 10 control participants who did not remove wheat and gluten deteriorated. Formal studies of nerve conduction were also performed, demonstrating improved nerve conduction in the wheat and gluten-free group and deterioration in the wheat and gluten-consuming group. Because the human nervous system is a complex web of nerve cells and networks, peripheral neuropathy triggered by wheat gluten exposure can show itself in a variety of ways, depending on what collection of nerves are affected. Loss of sensation to both legs, along with poor leg muscle control, is the most common, called sensory motor axonal peripheral neuropathy. Less commonly, only one side of the body may be affected, asymmetrical neuropathy, or the autonomic nervous system, the part of the nervous system responsible for automatic functions, such as blood pressure, heart rate, and bowel and bladder control, can be affected. If the autonomic nervous system is affected, such phenomena as losing consciousness or becoming lightheaded while standing up due to poor blood pressure control, inability to empty the bladder or bowels, and inappropriately rapid heart rate can result. Peripheral neuropathy, regardless of how it is expressed, is progressive and will get worse and worse unless all wheat and gluten are removed. Dance the wheat away. When I first met Meredith, she was sobbing. She'd come to me because of a minor heart question, an EKG variant that proved benign. "Everything hurts, my feet especially," she said. "They've treated me with all kinds of drugs. I hate them because I've had lots of side effects. The one I just started 2 months ago makes me so hungry that I can't stop eating. I've gained 15 pounds." Meredith described how, in her work as a school teacher, she was barely able to stand in front of her class any longer because of the pain in her feet. More recently, she had also started to doubt her ability to walk, since she was also starting to feel unsteady and uncoordinated. Just getting dressed in the morning was taking longer and longer, due to both the pain as well as the increasing clumsiness that impaired such simple activities as putting on a pair of pants. Although only 56 years old, she was forced to use a cane. I asked her if her neurologist had any explanations for her disability. "None. They all say there's no good reason. I've just got to live with it. They can give me medicines to help with the pain, but it's probably going to get worse." That's when she broke down and started crying again. I suspected there was a wheat issue just by looking at Meredith. Beyond the obvious difficulty she had walking into the room, her face was puffy and red. She described her struggles with acid reflux and the abdominal cramping and bloating diagnosed as irritable bowel syndrome. She was about 60 pounds overweight and had a modest quantity of edema, water retention, in her calves and ankles. So I asked Meredith to venture down the wheat-free path. By this time, she was so desperate for any helpful advice that she agreed to try. I also took the gamble of scheduling her for a stress test that would require her to walk at a moderate speed up an incline on a treadmill. Meredith returned 2 weeks later. I asked her if she thought she could manage the treadmill. "No problem. I stopped all wheat immediately after I talked to you. It took about a week, but the pain started to go away. Right now, I have about 90% less pain than I had a couple of weeks ago. I'd say it's nearly gone. I've already stopped one of the medicines for the pain, and I think I'll stop the other later this week. She also, clearly, no longer needed her cane. She related how her acid reflux and irritable bowel symptoms had also disappeared completely, and she'd lost 9 pounds in the 2-week period. Meredith tackled the treadmill without difficulty, handily managing the 3.6 miles per hour, 14% grade. Whole grain brain. I think that we can all agree, higher brain functions, such as thinking, learning, and memory, should be off-limits to intruders. Our minds are deeply personal, representing the summation of everything that is you and your experiences. Who wants nosy neighbors or marketing pitchmen to gain access to the private domain of the mind? While the notion of telepathy is fascinating to think about, it's also really creepy to think that someone could read your thoughts. For Wheat, nothing is sacred. Not your cerebellum, not your cerebral cortex. While it can't read your mind, it sure can influence what goes on inside it. The effect of Wheat on the brain is more than just influence over mood, energy, and sleep. Actual brain damage is possible, as seen in cerebellar ataxia. But the cerebral cortex, the center of memory and higher thinking, the storehouse of you and your unique personality and memories, the brain's gray matter, can also be pulled into the immune battle with Wheat, resulting in encephalopathy or brain disease. Gluten encephalopathy shows itself as migraine headaches and stroke-like symptoms, such as loss of control over one arm or leg, difficulty speaking, or visual difficulties. On MRI of the brain, there is a characteristic evidence of damage surrounding blood vessels and cerebral tissue. Gluten encephalopathy will also show many of the same balance and coordination symptoms as those that occur with cerebellar ataxia. In one particularly disturbing Mayo Clinic study of 13 patients with a recent diagnosis of celiac disease, dementia was also diagnosed. Of those 13, frontal lobe biopsy, yes, brain biopsy, or post-mortem examination of the brain, failed to identify any other pathology beyond that associated with wheat gluten exposure. Prior to death or biopsy, the most common symptoms were memory loss, the inability to perform simple arithmetic, confusion, and change in personality. Of the 13, 9 died due to progressive impairment of brain function. Yes, fatal dementia from wheat. In what percentage of dementia sufferers can their deteriorating mind and memory be blamed on wheat? This question has not yet been satisfactorily answered. However, one British research group that has actively investigated this question has to date diagnosed 61 cases of encephalopathy, including dementia, due to wheat gluten. Wheat is therefore associated with dementia and brain dysfunction, triggering an immune response that infiltrates memory and mind. The research into the relationship of wheat, gluten, and brain damage is still preliminary, with many unanswered questions remaining. But what we do know is deeply troubling. I shudder to think what we might find next. Gluten sensitivity can also show itself as seizures. The seizures that arise in response to wheat tend to occur in young people, often teenagers. The seizures are typically of the temporal lobe variety, that is, originating in the temporal lobe of the brain, just beneath the ears. People with temporal lobe seizures experience hallucinations of smell and taste, odd and inappropriate emotional feelings, such as overwhelming fear for no cause, and repetitive behaviors, such as smacking the lips or hand movements. A peculiar syndrome of temporal lobe seizures, unresponsive to seizure medications, and triggered by calcium deposition in a part of the temporal lobe called the hippocampus, responsible for forming new memories, has been associated with both celiac disease and gluten sensitivity. Positive anti-gliadin antibodies and HLA markers without intestinal disease. Of celiac sufferers, from 1 to 5.5% can be expected to be diagnosed with seizures. Temporal lobe seizures triggered by wheat gluten are improved after gluten elimination. One study demonstrated that epileptics who experienced the much more serious generalized grand mal seizures were twice as likely, 19.6% compared to 10.6%, to have gluten sensitivity in the form of increased levels of anti-gliadin antibodies without celiac disease. It's a sobering thought that wheat has the capacity to reach into the human brain and caused changes in thought, behavior, and structure, occasionally to the point of provoking seizures. Is it wheat or is it gluten? Gluten is the component of wheat confidently linked with triggering destructive immune phenomena, whether expressed as celiac disease, cerebellar ataxia, or dementia. However, many health effects of wheat, including those on the brain and nervous system, have nothing to do with immune phenomena triggered by gluten. The addictive properties of wheat, for instance, expressed as overwhelming temptation and obsession, obstructed by opiate-blocking drugs, are not directly due to gluten, but to exorphins, the breakdown product of gluten. While the component of wheat responsible for behavioral distortions in people with schizophrenia and children with autism and ADHD has not been identified, it is likely that these phenomena are also due to wheat exorphins and not a gluten-triggered immune response. Unlike gluten sensitivity, which can usually be diagnosed with the antibody tests, there is at present no marker that can be measured to assess exorphin effects. Non-gluten effects can add to gluten effects. The psychological influence of wheat exorphins on appetite and impulse, or the glucose-insulin effects, and perhaps other effects of wheat that have yet to be described, can occur independently or in combination with immune effects. Someone suffering with undiagnosed intestinal celiac disease can have odd cravings for the food that damages their small intestine, but also show diabetic blood sugars with wheat consumption, along with wide mood swings. Someone else without celiac disease can accumulate visceral fat and show neurological impairment from wheat. Others may become helplessly tired, overweight, and diabetic, yet suffer neither intestinal nor nervous system immune effects of wheat gluten. The tangle of health consequences of wheat consumption is truly impressive. The tremendously varying way the neurological effects of wheat can be experienced complicates making the diagnosis. Potential immune effects can be gauged with antibody blood tests, but non-immune effects are not revealed by any blood test and are therefore more difficult to identify and quantify. The world of the wheat brain has just started giving way to the light of day. The brighter the light shines, the uglier the situation gets. Chapter 12. Bagel Face. Wheat's Destructive Effect on the Skin. If wheat and its effects can grasp hold of organs such as the brain, intestines, arteries, and bones, can it also affect the largest organ of the body, the skin? Indeed it can. And it can display its peculiar effects in more ways than Krispy Kreme has donuts. Despite its outwardly quiet facade, skin is an active organ, a hotbed of physiologic activity, a waterproof barrier fending off the attacks of billions of foreign organisms, regulating body temperature through sweat, enduring bumps and scrapes every day, regenerating itself to repel the constant barrage. Skin is the physical barrier separating you from the rest of the world. Each person's skin provides a home to 10 trillion bacteria, most of which assume residence in quiet symbiosis with their mammalian host. Any dermatologist can tell you that skin is the outward reflection of internal body processes. A simple blush demonstrates this fact. The acute and intense facial vasodilatation, capillary dilation, that results when you realize the guy you flipped off in traffic was your boss. But the skin reflects more than our emotional states. It can also display evidence of internal physical processes. Wheat can exert age-advancing skin effects, such as wrinkles and lost elasticity, through the formation of advanced glycation end products. But wheat has plenty more to say about your skin's health than just making you age faster. Wheat expresses itself, actually, the body's reaction to wheat expresses itself, through the skin. Just as digestive byproducts of wheat lead to joint inflammation, increased blood sugar, and brain effects, so too can they result in reactions in the skin, effects that range from petty annoyances to life-threatening ulcers and gangrene. Skin changes do not generally occur in isolation. If an abnormality due to wheat is expressed on the skin's surface, then it usually means that the skin is not the only organ experiencing an unwanted response. Other organs may be involved, from intestines to brain, though you may not be aware of it. Yo, pimple face. Acne, the common affliction of adolescents and young adults, responsible for more distress than prom night. 19th century doctors called it stone pock, While ancient physicians often made issue of the rash-like appearance, minus the itching, the condition has been attributed to everything from emotional struggles, especially those involving shame or guilt, to deviant sexual behavior. Treatments were often dreadful, including powerful laxatives and enemas, foul-smelling sulfur baths, and prolonged exposure to X-ray. Aren't the teenage years already tough enough? As if teenagers need any more reason to feel awkward, acne visits the 12 to 18-year-old set with uncommon frequency. It is, along with the onslaught of bewildering hormonal effects, a nearly universal phenomenon in Western cultures, affecting more than 80% of teenagers, up to 95% of 16 to 18-year-olds, sometimes to disfiguring degrees. Adults are not spared, with 50% of those over age 25 having intermittent bouts. While acne may be nearly universal in American teenagers, it is not a universal phenomenon in all cultures. Some cultures display no acne whatsoever. Cultures as wide-ranging as the Catawan Islanders of Papua New Guinea, the Aché hunter-gatherers of Paraguay, natives of the Purus Valley in Brazil, African Bantus and Zulus, Japan's Okinawans, and Canadian Inuit are curiously spared the nuisance and embarrassment of acne. Are these cultures spared the heartbreak of acne because of unique genetic immunity? Evidence suggests that it is not a genetic issue, but one of diet. Cultures that rely only on foods provided by their unique location and climate allow us to observe the effects of foods added or subtracted to the diet. Acne-free populations, such as the Catawans of New Guinea, exist on a hunter-gatherer diet of vegetables, fruits, tubers, coconuts, and fish. The Paraguayan Aché hunter-gatherers follow a similar diet, along with adding land animals and cultivated manioc, peanuts, rice, and maize, and are also spared completely from acne. Japanese Okinawans, probably the most long-lived group on planet Earth, until the 1980s consumed a diet rich in an incredible array of vegetables, sweet potatoes, soy, pork, and fish. Acne was virtually unknown among them. The traditional Inuit diet, consisting of seal, fish, caribou, and whatever seaweed, berries, and roots that are found, likewise leaves Inuits acne-free. The diets of African Bantus and Zulus differ according to season and terrain, but are rich in indigenous wild plants such as guava, mangoes, and tomatoes, in addition to the fish and wild game they catch. Once again, no acne. In other words, cultures without acne consume little to no wheat, sugar, or dairy products. As Western influence introduced processed starches such as wheat and sugars into groups such as the Okinawans, Inuits, and Zulus, acne promptly followed. In other words, acne-free cultures had no special genetic protection from acne, but simply followed a diet that lacked the foods that provoked the condition. Introduce wheat, sugar, and dairy products, and Clearasil sales skyrocket. Ironically, it was common knowledge in the early 20th century that acne was caused or worsened by eating starchy foods such as pancakes and biscuits. This notion fell out of favor in the 80s after a single wrong-headed study that compared the effects of a chocolate bar versus a placebo candy bar. The study concluded that there was no difference in acne observed among the 65 participants, regardless of which bar they consumed, except that the placebo bar was virtually the same as the chocolate bar in calories, sugar, and fat content, just minus the cocoa. Cocoa lovers have cause to rejoice. Cocoa does not cause acne. Enjoy your 85% cocoa dark chocolate. This didn't stop the dermatologic community, however, from poo-pooing the relationship of acne and diet for many years, largely based on this single study that was cited repeatedly. In fact, modern dermatology largely claims ignorance on just why so many modern teenagers and adults experience this chronic, sometimes disfiguring condition. Though discussions center around infection with Propionibacterium acnes, inflammation, and excessive sebum production, treatments are aimed at suppressing acne eruption, not in identifying causes. So, dermatologists are quick to prescribe topical antibacterial creams and ointments, oral antibiotics, and anti-inflammatory drugs. More recently, studies have once again pointed at carbohydrates as the trigger of acne formation, working their acne-promoting effects via increased levels of insulin. The means by which insulin triggers acne formation is beginning to yield to the light of day. Insulin stimulates the release of a hormone called insulin-like growth factor 1, or IGF-1, within the skin. IGF-1, in turn, stimulates tissue growth in hair follicles and in the dermis, the layer of skin just beneath the surface. Insulin and IGF-1 also stimulate the production of sebum, the oily protective film produced by the sebaceous glands. Overproduction of sebum, along with skin tissue growth, leads to the characteristic upward-growing reddened pimple. Indirect evidence for insulin's role in causing acne also comes from other experiences. Women with polycystic ovarian syndrome, PCOS, who demonstrate exaggerated insulin responses and higher blood sugars, are strikingly prone to acne. Medications that reduce insulin and glucose in women with PCOS, such as the drug metformin, reduce acne. While oral diabetes medications are usually not administered to children, it has been observed that young people who take oral diabetes medications that reduce blood sugar and insulin do experience less acne. Insulin levels are highest after carbohydrates are consumed. The higher the glycemic index of the consumed carbohydrate, the more insulin is released by the pancreas. Of course, wheat, with its uncommonly high glycemic index, triggers higher blood sugar than nearly all other foods, thereby triggering insulin more than nearly all other foods. It should come as no surprise that wheat, especially in the form of sugary donuts and cookies, that is, high glycemic index wheat with high glycemic index sucrose, causes acne. But it's also true of your multigrain bread, cleverly disguised as healthy. Also in line with insulin's ability to provoke acne formation is the role of dairy. While most health authorities obsess over the fat content of dairy and recommend low-fat or skim products, acne is not caused by the fat. The unique proteins in bovine products are the culprit that trigger insulin out of proportion to the sugar content, a unique insulinotropic property that explains the 20% increase in severe acne in teenagers consuming milk. Overweight and obese teenagers generally get that way not through overconsumption of spinach or green peppers, nor of salmon or tilapia, but of carbohydrate foods such as breakfast cereals. Overweight and obese teenagers, accordingly, should have more acne than slender teenagers, and that is indeed the case. The heavier the child, the more likely he or she is to have acne. It does not mean that slender kids can't have acne, but that statistical likelihood of acne increases with body weight. As we would expect from this line of reasoning, nutritional efforts that reduce insulin and blood sugar should reduce acne. A recent study compared a high glycemic index diet to a low glycemic index diet consumed by college students over 12 weeks. The low GI diet yielded 23.5% less acne lesions, compared to a 12% reduction in the control group. Participants who cut their carbohydrate intake the most enjoyed nearly a 50% reduction in the number of acne lesions. In short, foods that increase blood sugar and insulin trigger the formation of acne. Wheat increases blood sugar, and thereby insulin, more than nearly all other foods. The whole grain bread you feed your teenager in the name of health actually worsens the problem. Though not life-threatening in and of itself, acne can nonetheless lead the sufferer to resort to all manner of treatments, some potentially toxic, such as isotretinoin, which impairs night vision, can modify thoughts and behavior, and causes grotesque congenital malformations in developing fetuses. Alternatively, elimination of wheat reduces acne. By also eliminating dairy and other processed carbohydrates such as chips, tacos, and tortillas, you'll largely disable the insulin machinery that triggers acne formation. If there's such a thing in this world, you might even have a grateful teenager on your hands. Want to see my rash? Dermatitis herpetiformis, DH, described as skin inflammation in the form of herpes, is yet another way that an immune reaction to wheat gluten can show itself outside of the intestinal tract. It is an itchy, herpes-like, meaning similar-looking bumps. It has nothing to do with the herpes virus, rash that persists and can eventually leave discolored patches and scars. The most commonly affected areas are the elbows, knees, buttocks, scalp, and back, usually involving both sides of the body symmetrically. However, DH can also appear in less common ways, such as sores in the mouth, on the penis or vagina, or odd bruising over the palms. A skin biopsy is often required to identify the characteristic inflammatory response. Curiously, most DH sufferers do not experience intestinal symptoms of celiac disease, but most still show intestinal inflammation and destruction characteristic of celiac. People with DH are therefore subject to all the potential complications shared by people with typical celiac disease if they continue to consume wheat gluten, including intestinal lymphoma, autoimmune inflammatory diseases, and diabetes. Obviously, the treatment for DH is strict elimination of wheat and other gluten sources. The rash can improve within days in some people, while in others it dissipates gradually over months. Particularly bothersome cases, or DH that recurs because of continued wheat gluten consumption, sadly very common, can be treated with the drug Dapsone, which is taken orally. Also used to treat leprosy, this is a potentially toxic drug marked by side effects such as headache, weakness, liver damage, and occasionally seizures and coma. Okay, so we consume wheat and develop itchy, annoying, disfiguring rashes as a result. We then apply a potentially toxic drug to allow us to continue to consume wheat, but expose ourselves to very high risk for intestinal cancers and autoimmune diseases. Does this really make sense? After acne, DH is the most common skin manifestation of a reaction to wheat gluten. But an incredible range of conditions beyond DH are also triggered by wheat gluten, some associated with increased levels of celiac antibodies, others not. Most of these conditions can also be caused by other factors, such as drugs, viruses, or cancer. Wheat gluten, like drugs, viruses, and cancer, therefore shares the potential to cause any of these rashes. Wheat gluten-related rashes and other skin manifestations include oral ulcers, red inflamed tongue, glossitis, angular colitis, painful sores on the corner of the mouth, and mouth burning are common forms of oral rashes associated with wheat gluten. Cutaneous vasculitis, raised bruise-like skin lesions that have inflamed blood vessels identified by biopsy. Acanthosis nigricans, black, velvety skin that usually grows on the back of the neck, but also on the armpits, elbows, and knees. Acanthosis nigricans is frighteningly common in children and adults prone to diabetes. Erythema nodosum, shiny red, hot, and painful 1 to 2 inch lesions that typically appear on the shins, but can occur just about anywhere else. Erythema nodosum represents inflammation of the fatty layer of the skin. They leave a brown, depressed scar on healing. Psoriasis, a reddened, scaly rash, usually over the elbows, knees, and scalp, and occasionally the entire body. Improvement on a wheat and gluten-free diet may require several months. Vitiligo, common painless patches of non-pigmented white skin. Once established, vitiligo responds inconsistently to wheat gluten elimination. Behçet's disease. These ulcers of the mouth and genitalia generally afflict teenagers and young adults. Behçet's can also show itself in myriad other ways, such as psychosis due to brain involvement, incapacitating fatigue, and arthritis. Dermatomyositis, a red swollen rash that occurs in combination with muscle weakness and blood vessel inflammation. Ichthyosiform dermatoses, an odd scaly rash, ichthyosiform means fish-like, that usually involves the mouth and tongue. Pyoderma gangrenosum, horrific disfiguring ulcers involving the face and limbs that are deeply scarring and can become chronic. Treatments include immune-suppressing agents such as steroids and cyclosporine. The condition can lead to gangrene, limb amputation, and death. All of these conditions have been associated with wheat gluten exposure, and their improvement or cure observed with removal. For the majority of these conditions, the proportion due to wheat gluten versus other causes is not known, since wheat gluten is often not considered as a potential cause. In fact, most commonly, a cause is not sought, and treatment is instituted blindly in the form of steroid creams and other drugs. Believe it or not, as frightening as this list appears, it is only partial. There are quite a few more skin conditions associated with wheat gluten that are not listed here. You can see that skin conditions triggered by wheat gluten range from simple nuisance to disfiguring disease. Outside of the relatively common mouth ulcers and acanthosis nigricans, most of these skin manifestations of wheat gluten exposure are uncommon, but in the aggregate, they add up to an impressive list of socially disruptive, emotionally difficult, and physically disfiguring conditions. Are you getting the impression that humans and wheat gluten may be incompatible? Who needs Nair? Compared to the great apes and other primates, modern Homo sapiens are relatively hairless, so we prize what little hair we have. My dad used to urge me to eat hot chili peppers because it will grow hair on your chest. What if Dad's advice was